KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I'm from the Upper Castro.
East Oakland.
Lake Mary, Oakland, what's poppin'?
Coming up, Chinese American youth change San Francisco policy about mental health services at high schools.
I began to value my academics more than my mental health and my physical health. My mindset was instilled with the constant belief that I was worthless.
Then the band Santana celebrates the 20th anniversary of their album Supernatural. Former lead singer Tony Lindsay tells us what it's like to be part of music history.
Being a part of that Santana legacy, that's something that's written in stone.
And we'll meet the people who cleaned the streets after San Francisco's Pride Parade.
It's our own little parade of cleanup.
The aftermath of Pride Weekend, Cross Currents, is coming up. San Francisco's Chinese Progressive Association runs a youth leadership program. Teens who participate take on an in-depth project every few years. That's how they sharpen their advocacy and public speaking skills. Their most recent campaign was deeply personal. Youth leaders realized that many of them had struggled with mental health issues, and they hadn't gotten any help at their high schools. So they did some research, put out a study, and changed district policy. Last week, the San Francisco Unified Board of Education unanimously approved their resolution. It's called Our Healing in Our Hands, and it marks an important shift in the way high school wellness centers will be run. Spoiler alert, the young people gave themselves the power to decide what works. KLW education reporter Lee Romney is here to tell us more. Hi.
Hello, Hannah.
So who are these young people?
Well, almost all the kids in Youth Mojo, which stands for Movement of Justice and Organizing, come from low-income Chinese immigrant families. Mm-hmm. And for their advocacy projects, they've worked on issues that directly impact their families, like healthcare and workers' rights. Mm-hmm. This time, they looked more broadly at all immigrant youth and kids of color. But their project still stemmed from their own very specific experiences as Asian students and some of the stereotypes that go along with that.
Mm-hmm. Like what? What stereotypes are we talking about?
Well, a lot of these high school kids talk about how they're perceived as high academic achievers who are introverted but doing just fine. That's the model minority myth. Mm-hmm. But it turns out to be pretty far from the truth. A lot of these kids have suffered from depression and anxiety in high school. Some have been suicidal or they have had good friends who were. So they said in a lot of cases they weren't getting referred to school mental health services, and most weren't going on their own either because of what they saw as the stigma around admitting that they needed help.
Right.
Here's youth leader Elizabeth Gao, who just graduated from George Washington High School.
I was caught in a toxic cycle of striving for perfection and maintaining that perfection. I began to value my academics more than my mental health and my physical health. My mindset was instilled with the constant belief that I was worthless. To summarize, I couldn't and didn't love myself.
Wow. So, Lee, you mentioned that a lot of these young people weren't finding guidance that they needed. What is the San Francisco Unified School District doing to help out?
Well, the district is doing exceptionally well in a lot of ways in this area. Every single high school has a wellness center, and that's not common for high schools. The first one opened actually in the year 2000, and these are supposed to be safe, confidential settings where experts help teens cope with a whole bunch of things like stress, trauma, bullying, drug and alcohol use, sexual health, relationships. That's their mandate, at least. Mm-hmm. But the young people from Youth Mojo didn't feel like they were connecting with those services. Here's Elizabeth again, talking about her experience with her high school wellness center.
The representatives there always talked about, oh, come in and get condoms or come in to like get any like physical health needs. We'll always provide for you. But there was never like a really big serious mention about mental health in those assemblies. And I just realized there's this stigma around like seeking for help.
So Lee, that does sound like a big problem. What did these kids do about it?
They did some research. So they had adult mentors from the Chinese Progressive Association help them. They designed a survey. They took it out in the community. Nearly 1,000 high school students filled it out, and not just Chinese American students, but also Arab American, Middle Eastern students, other Asian Pacific Islander kids, Latinx youth, some Black students. And they asked in the survey about feelings of safety, about bullying, mm-hmm. and about whether these students were using the wellness centers at their high schools, and if not, why not?
Mm-hmm. And what did they find?
Well, a lot of the students talked about not feeling safe, especially youth whose primary home language is not English. Arab or Middle Eastern students were more likely than any other racial or ethnic group to be bullied for all reasons listed in the survey, they mm-hmm. found. And a lot of students said they were missing school because of stress, anxiety, and depression. When it came to the wellness centers, the survey confirmed that many kids were not winding up there to talk about their mental health needs. In fact, other than Latinx and Pacific Islander students, all students of color were less likely than white students to use the wellness centers for any reason at all.
Wow, why not?
Not comfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, almost half the Asian American respondents, more than a third of Latinx students, and more than a quarter of African American students said talking to a stranger was a barrier to using the wellness center services. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They didn't feel the services were culturally responsive enough. Mm. In some cases, language is a barrier too. Many also said they didn't know about the services. They just didn't know, and they didn't know how to access them. And the report concluded that adults were less likely to refer Asian American students because of that model minority myth that I talked about.
Right. So how did those findings then end up changing policy?
Well, the youth and their mentors talked to Board of Education members, and three of the commissioners who just took office in January signed on to co-sponsor the Our Healing in Our Hands resolution. Mm. One is Fauga Moliga. He's a Samoan-American social worker who grew up in the Bayview, in Bayview Public Housing, and he says therapy saved his life. Mm. Another is Jenny Lam, and she's Chinese-American and describes herself as a daughter of immigrants and a granddaughter of war. Mm. So she recognizes some of the traumas that Asian American families can carry, but they don't often discuss or acknowledge.
Right.
And then there's Allison Collins, who's African American, an educator, and a longtime parent activist.
Three people of color making a difference. What's going to change now?
So the changes come in three key areas. One is funding, and it will go in part to hire more wellness center social workers and therapists specifically to serve immigrant youth and students of color. Mm-hmm. The second is a new policy that will make sure students have a say in how the wellness centers are run, how they're funded, and who gets hired. And then the third change is super important. It calls for the creation of a peer-to-peer support program. They call it coaching, but peer-to-peer support, because a lot of students say they feel more comfortable sharing their mental health experiences with somebody their own age, at least initially. And so that will start with pilot programs in 2 to 3 schools, and they're looking at Washington, June Jordan, and Balboa High.
All right. So money-wise, how much is this going to cost?
A district fiscal analysis pegged the cost at $1.3 million.
Okay. And when is this kicking off?
They'll start implementing in the coming school year.
Okay. Thank you, Lee.
Thank you.
Lee is KLW's education reporter. Reach her at education@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. This summer marks the 20th anniversary of Supernatural, Santana's wildly successful Grammy-winning 1999 album, which has become one of the best-selling albums of all time. One of the singers on that album was Tony Lindsay, Santana's lead singer from the early 90s to 2015. He continues to perform regularly at clubs throughout the Bay Area, and he recently stopped by KLW for this edition of Bay Area Beats. He shares what it means to be part of the Santana legacy and why he doesn't plan on retiring anytime soon.
My name is Tony Lindsay. I was born and raised back in Kingston, New York. I started when I was 8 years old singing. We had an a cappella singing group called Four of a Kind. And we used to win a lot of
competitions and the talent shows and all that kind of stuff. And my dad used to work in the hotels back in upstate New York. So he would always like, hey, you know, my son's singing group is pretty cool. You need to bring them in. You know, our parents never had to worry about where we were. We went to school, came home, we did our homework, and then we went to practice. And we'd be singing on street corners. And when I left to go to college at Albany State University, that's when the group split up, because at that point I was leaving town and I wasn't coming back. And I haven't turned around. I haven't turned back since, man. It's been, I've been telling people I've been having a great time since I was 7, 8 years old, and it's continuing. San Jose was my first stop when I came to California. That was in 1980. First thing I did, I went and found a job and all that kind of stuff, and it wasn't making that much money. I've always done music, always had a band or was involved in a band, even though I would work at men's clothing stores and all that. And I did that for a reason, because, you know, work at a men's clothing store, you can get a serious discount, or sometimes even get stuff for free. So, you know, I had to look good while I was on stage. Back then, there were music venues, live music venues all over the place, man. I mean, the Bay Area was just full of them. I was out every night of the week, going, checking out new clubs. I'd drive to San Francisco. I would go to Sacramento. I'd go to Monterey, just checking out all the clubs and started sitting in with people. And that's how I made my connections. Next thing you know, boom, things started taking off. Woodstock is 8 miles from where I was born and raised. You know, I was too young to kind of understand that kind of stuff back then. You know, that was the age that I was listening to we were doing Temptation stuff and all that. You know, and then somebody says, hey, Santana. We're like, who's Santana? But after that Woodstock concert happened, we all knew who Santana was. Chester Thompson was the keyboard player with Tower of Power for a long time. So when Chester left Tower of Power, he went to Santana. So Chester came out to see us one time, and he says, hey man, you know, we're on break now from Santana thing. He says, but Santana's looking for a new vocalist, and you know, if you want me to throw your name in the pot, I'd be happy to do it. They sent me a tape of about 4 songs for the audition. We got through 2 songs, and Carl said, I'm cool, I don't need to hear anymore. So I actually kind of took it that, well, maybe he didn't dig it. Got home later that night, and there had to be at least 12 or 13 voice messages on my answering machine with Kevin Chisholm, the manager at the time for Santana. Hey, man, Carlos really likes you, man. Call us back. And then there'd be another one. Hey, man, you know, are you going to call us back or what? He wants to know if you want to do the gig. So I finally called him back that night, and that was it. The rest is history. You know, with that Santana band, man, there's been a lot of great different bands that have been there. But I think I got, besides the original cats, because when that band came out, it was ridiculous. I think I got the next best chunk of that whole existence of the Santana band. And I'm glad I was in there when I was there, because I'm a part of Supernatural. You really never know when you're doing something, when you're recording, how it's going to turn out. And we didn't know. You know, it was a good CD, but we had no idea the impact that record had. We were on tour in Europe while they were still promoting it. So when we got back home off tour and found out that CD was blown up like it was like, wow, because we were in this bubble over there for the longest time. And when we came back and seen how much of a hit that thing was, it was like, wow. We got 11 Grammys for that, you know, and I got all 11 of them at my house. Not only we got 11 Grammys, we got an American Music Award, we got the BAMMY Award, we got so many awards that year. It was crazy, man. Being a part of that Santana legacy now, it's part of history now. That's something that's written in stone. So it's really cool being a part of that. Because, you know, people connect me with that Santana band. You can't, the disconnection is not going to happen at this point. And I got a lot of fans all over the world, too. I always thank Carlos about that. Thanks for sharing your audience with me. Because, you know, for me to know and say that I was a part of the Santana band for 25 years, man, that's big stuff, man. Big stuff. I knew that when I was like 8 years old, I knew it was what I wanted to do. I mean, they got so much enjoyment out of singing, you know, and I'm going to do that until I'm no longer on this earth. I'm going to keep on doing that. I'm never going to retire. You know, it's cool, too, because if something happened and my legs don't work anymore, I can sit down and sing. I'm always going to be doing it, man. What else? I tell my wife all the time, they're going to carry me from the stage to the morgue.
That was former Santana lead singer Tony Lindsay. His new album called Something Beautiful is available now. And you can catch him performing live this Friday night with the Ray Charles Project that's at Freight and Salvage in Berkeley. That piece was produced by Beau Walsh. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Almost a million people were at last Sunday's Pride March in San Francisco. It's one of the biggest events in the city. But after all is said and done, who cleans everything up? Priya Mahadevan has that story.
Is San Francisco in the house? I can't hear you. Is San Francisco in the house? Because we are here for Pride. Pride 2019.
If you missed San Francisco's Pride March, let me paint a picture for you. Every year on the last Sunday of June, San Francisco shuts down Market Street for a massive parade of floats that starts at the Embarcadero and ends at the Civic Center. People line the sidewalks holding signs, passing out flyers, wearing feathers and rainbow flare, and throwing glitter in the air. But turns out there are actually two parades.
We start cleaning right following the last float. And then it's our own little parade of cleanup.
This is Peter Lau, Superintendent for Street and Environmental Services for San Francisco's Department of Public Works. I met him in his office 2 weeks before Pride to get a lay of the land. He's in charge of everyday street cleaning for the whole city, but also big events like Pride, Beta Breakers, and the Chinese New Year Parade. Peter works with a crew of almost 100 full-time staff from the Department of Public Works, or DPW. They'll be putting in extra time to work the overnight Pride shift.
It's full bore. We're just like cleaning up until 4 a.m. It's just nonstop.
There's a whole complicated choreography of who cleans what when. It's like a dance. First, the corridor ambassadors enter with brooms and leaf blowers. Their job is to move the debris from the sidewalks and edges of the street into the middle of the road. Then you've got the steamers, who do the same thing, but with manual power washers. So So now you've got a whole pile of garbage in the center of the street. How does that help? In come the street sweepers. These are the same trucks that you see doing daily street cleaning around the city. They vacuum up that pile of garbage. These trucks can hold between 5 and 10 tons of trash, which may sound like a lot, but throughout the night, they have to keep emptying their load. Finally, there comes the flusher. It's a lot like a street sweeper, but instead of sucking up garbage, it spews out thousands of gallons of water. The idea is to get rid of any remaining icky sticky stuff the sweeper might have missed. But Pride is a little different than most events. Glitter and confetti won't just sit in a pile in the middle of the street for very long, especially if it's windy. So sometimes the flusher will go through first to weigh down all that light fluffy stuff, and then the sweeper will swing by to catch it before it dries up. It's a delicate balancing act. I wanted to see this all for myself and meet the people who work their magic on the margins. So I head to the Embarcadero around noon on Pride Sunday to hang out with DPW late into the night.
Okay, I'm here. The cleanup is getting ready to begin, and I've got coffee. I'm ready to go.
The first person I meet down at Mission and Stewart Street is Kenny Bruce.
Assistant Superintendent for Street Cleaning Citywide Operations. I've been with the department 29 years.
After 29 years, Kenny is calm, confident, and assertive in his role, but also polite with his crew. He's got a goatee and sunglasses on, and he's always scanning the horizon for things that need to get done.
It is just crazy, and that's the way it always is.
Kenny is in charge of making sure everything goes as smoothly and quickly as possible. He introduces me to Guillermo Perez, who's stationed at the tail end of the cleanup procession, making sure nothing's getting left behind. As a native San Franciscan, Guillermo is enthusiastic about this work.
This is my home, so I feel like I'm just contributing back to my neighborhood, towards my city.
And then there's Milton Lau, no relation to Peter Lau. He's a corridor worker. We start talking during a delay in the parade, and while most of the crew waits for further instructions, Milton takes out a metal scraper and squats down to clean gum off the sidewalk.
How long have you been working for the Harbor Public Works?
About a year.
About a year? Nice. How do you like it?
I'm a homeless person, so I'm glad they gave me a job.
Milton's been homeless for more than a decade. He's originally from Hawaii.
The reason why I came to Frisco is because I used to have a bunch of old gay friends, and I was hoping I'd meet up with them. But unfortunately, when I got here, I found out they either passed away or expired or something happened. And they're not here anymore.
Milton's bisexual, but he's not a big fan of Pride. He says he thinks it's just a big party now, and he feels like people today are indifferent to those who had to fight to get their rights. But he likes working for DPW.
For me, it's more like fun than actual work.
I end up having so many conversations with DPW workers like Milton about a whole range of topics, from spirituality to gentrification to acceptance and identity. While most people are here to cheer for all the colorful floats and enthusiastic marchers, it feels like I'm witnessing a slightly different version of the event. It's a lot less glamorous, but still full of pride. Eventually, the parade comes to a close, and that's when the DPW crew really get to work. They're doubling back and forth with street sweepers and flushers to get as much trash as they can off the streets. I'm in Guillermo's truck, and his CB radio is going crazy.
93 DLC. Go ahead, Kenny Bruce.
There's a lot of coordination happening between city departments, like SFPD and MTA, to make sure roads don't open too early and DPW workers are safe.
Do not spray any water up here by all this electrical equipment. They're still breaking down the stage.
10-4, copy that.
All right, removing the barricades at Beale and Market. Sweepers are going to go on to Beale now.
The corridor worker was punched in the face.
But things only get more hectic as the night goes on. As the crew begins to clean around City Hall, I meet up with Peter Lau. The meticulous choreography he told me about in his office looks a lot more chaotic in real life. He says the tight area and tricky streets around Civic Center make it especially challenging.
It's just sort of how the night goes. We kind of just roll with it.
Peter jets from one task to another. He's breaking down barricades that were left up, moving around boxes, making sure the full sweeper trucks are emptied out.
By 4 o'clock, it won't look like we're never here.
That's what I kept hearing from this crew. The goal is to make it look like Pride never happened. that 1 million people didn't leave behind more than 70,000 pounds of trash. And by Monday morning rush hour, the streets are back to normal, filled with buses and Ubers and pedestrians and your garden variety litter bugs. Soon enough, this street will need another cleaning, and DPW will be back. At City Hall, I'm Priya Mahadevan for Cross Currents.
That story was produced with help from Taylor Caldwell. Go online to KALW.org to hear more stories from all around the Bay Area. And make sure you're subscribed to our newsletter to get our interviews and stories in your inbox every week. This music is by Adrian West from San Francisco. He's playing at the Ivy Room in Albany tomorrow night.
Autumn leaves blazing in the sun. Crispy apple, sweet and sour on my tongue. My lover's arms hold me in the dark. Open promises and broken hearts.
And today's team includes Janae Darden, Sophie Codner, Lisa Morehouse, Adriana Morga, True Gwynn, Marissa Ortega-Welch, Jocelyn Tabankai, and Eli Wortschafter. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Content manager is Kristen McCandless. Our managing editor is David Boyer. Deputy news director is Angela Johnston. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
The torn expression on its face I've seen. It's like a big machine. Beware that you and I don't count for much, but we can share the human touch.